This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. My name continues to be the one on the website, Sam. And joining me today is Dave. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm still proud that we actually convinced you to do that.
Yeah, I still feel like remember it may have been the third or fourth time Steve Martin was on Saturday Night Live back when I was as a host.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran into the back and there was a TV of what was happening on the screen, and he goes, "Look, it's me looking at me, looking at me, looking at me." And it feels a little bit like that whenever I go, "Ask an Atheist with Sam Olvey." Yeah.
So
yeah.
You could be like certain presidential nominees and just slap your name on every building, every item, every utensil, anything.
Yeah.
that's not narcissistic at all.
I might do toilet paper.
There we go.
All right. So we're doing another segment in our continuing gritty reboot series. So pretend that I'm missing an eye and I replaced one of my legs with a chainsaw, which is a lot less effective than...
You suddenly look more like Bruce Campbell.
No, Bruce Campbell did it right. And also, yeah, way better chin than mine will ever be.
If chins could talk,
yeah.
I believe that's the name of his memoirs.
It is, yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying I don't have chin envy. In fact, I have chin envy. But... So, today we're talking about a subject that we have been so tired of talking about it, there is actually a button dedicated to it on my broadcast board.
Do we want to listen to the, because we never actually let people listen.
I think we're going to end on it.
Okay.
Oh, wait, no. That's a really good idea, because that's a great introduction. So, there is a button on my board right here that's labeled Pascal's Wager. And every time... we get a Pascal's Wager email, I press this button and then we talk over it. But now I'm going to press it and we're not going to talk over it. It sounds a little bit like this.
Pascal's Wager assumes a false equivalence between the existence of God and the non-existence of God. The assertion that God exists, especially a specific God like Yahweh, is far more unlikely than the assumption that God doesn't exist. It also assumes that verisimilitude of faith is equally acceptable to God as genuine belief, or that God would be fooled by feigned conviction. Therefore, the more logical position would be disbelief, regardless of the thread attached.
Dave, you wrote that.
I did write that. I'm actually pretty proud of that.
I think you have every right to be pretty proud of it, because it's very well done.
Well, thank you.
It's one of the most succinct refutations of Pascal's Wager that I've ever read. And now our ongoing discussion is going to be a not very succinct at all refutation of Pascal's Wager. Now, the interesting thing about Pascal's Wager is that it's usually the point of a spear in a religious argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons that I introduced the Pascal's Wager button is that I can press this button. Here's refutations of Pascal's Wager, so we can get that out of the way right away.
Let's move on to your other arguments.
Now we can talk about the weirdness and, yeah, the strange crap that Pascal's Wager is usually attached to. And this was a topic we originally visited in 2011, and so we're going to talk a little bit about the same things that we talked about then, but
mm-hmm.
I guess with the, you know, with the perspective that 6 years brings, you know, doing this show.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Blaise Pascal first. He's a French mathematician and philosopher who lived in the 1600s. He made the argument that by believing in a god, a person would have everything to gain and nothing to lose. One paraphrase of the argument is, if you believe in God and turn out to be incorrect, you have lost nothing. But if you don't believe in God and turn out to be incorrect, you will go to hell. Therefore, it is foolish to be an atheist. Now, first and foremost, this is what everybody knows Pascal about. Blaise Pascal did a lot other stuff.
He was one of the founding mathematicians, like some of the key, like, theorems and formula that we still use today was thought of by this guy. I always think it's interesting when we run into these guys from the, you know, late Middle Ages, Renaissance, early Romantic era, because when we think of a scientist today, there's very specific rules, and not exactly rules, but sort of, what's the word, you know, methods they use, and
right.
you know, they take steps to separate their own beliefs from what the evidence says, and they, you know, they're not always objective, but they try to be.
Yeah.
Back then, they hadn't really nailed all that down.
Well, this was the time when how to do that was most recently figured out.
Right.
I mean, but he did some really important stuff in mathematics with coefficients.
Mm-hmm.
He was also an early proponent of vacuum. because before then, you know, we're talking about ether theory and, you know, Aristotelian stuff. So this is a guy, right. this is a guy, it is just and proper to have a lot of respect for this guy, because he yeah. did a lot of stuff.
Yes.
Now, later in life, things changed, and he got really, you know, into the theological end of it, and I'm a little less concerned with, or that I'm a little less happy about.
Right.
Because this is the main output. This is the takeaway. I mean, he wrote a lot more than just this, even on theology.
Right. This would be like if Isaac Newton was only known for his alchemy. There'd be so much lost if
yes.
we only paid attention to that part. And for Blaise Pascal, it's kind of like that. Like, people only know him for this weird, crazy religious stage he went through towards the end of his life.
Absolutely. So, basically, in summation, it purports to be based in reason and logic. In reason, I'm sorry, I'll try that again. It purports to be based in reason and logic, but relies entirely on an emotional response, fear of hell and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a little bit a logic based, you know, it's got a logical supposition in
structure.
It. It's got a logical structure, but it's the foundations of the logical argument are emotional based. So it's logical presumption, or it's logical argument based on an emotional response. So.
Right.
It's not a logical argument.
There is no proof that you can do for the beginning parts of this logical statement. You can't prove the, if you believe in God, it is incorrect, blah, blah, blah. Like, they sound logical, but they're not. I'm repeating the same thing you're saying. But yeah. it's just, like, it sounds so good at first until you stop and think for just 10 seconds about it.
Right. So let's go into some specific reasons why it stinks. The first one is kind of the easiest one. If you choose to believe and get it wrong, it's not without loss. You lose time.
You lose time. You lose, well, particularly in as it applies to Pascal's wager, I don't know if Buddhists ever pull out Pascal's wager or Muslims or other religions, because I always hear it as a fundamentalist Christian argument.
I have heard one Muslim use Pascal's wager.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I think it was Harun Yahya.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But if you take the fundamentalist Christian attitude, you're not just losing time, you're losing freedom.
Right.
Because once you accept the tenets of that religion, it severely restricts the way you act and changes the way you act. That is hardly without cost. I mean,
yeah. And, you know, back in these days, the tithing wasn't an unknown thing. So you were also going to lose 10% of your income.
Exactly.
And depending on the religion that you decide to follow, there is a huge potential for loss.
Mm-hmm.
And if the atheist perspective ends up being correct and there isn't an afterlife, you don't have as much time as you would like to spare. This is a significant loss.
Yeah. This is one of the, almost one of the key understandings of our worldview, is that we only have now to do the things we want.
Right.
We only have this world to fix or to live in, to leave for the next generation. We only have what's here. So we have to take care of it, and we have to use it wisely, and we have to do, you know, you don't want to waste it because you don't have an eternity to back it up.
Right. And this, okay, so the next thing is, this is the one that really frosts my behind on this one. This is, I really, it just goes to show how little a lot of people who use Pascal's wager conceive of their God. If an omniscient God would be able to see through my hedged bets.
Right.
If I don't really believe he's there, but or if from a logical perspective or from a realistic perspective, when you get past all the weirdness and all the, you know, all double thinking, what is that called?
Cognitive dissonance.
I don't really believe this. I'm just doing it because I'm just
right.
doing it out of fear of hell. Your God isn't going to see through that.
You know, God's sitting there saying, well, he did go through the motions, and I guess that's what's important.
Okay. Well, yeah, if you, you know what, if you're a Calvinist, fine. But if you're a Calvinist, I have way larger problems with you than this one, as a start.
But yeah, the idea, because it's one of those basic beliefs of this kind of Christianity, that God knows everything, including every thought you have, and every lie you tell yourself, and every justification you make, and God supposedly knows all of this, so he's going to know all of this, like,
right,
going through the motions crap.
Right. And the next one is, it ignores other religions.
This is the one. So you say the last one is the one that really gets you. This is the one that really gets me, because it's the false equivalency. It's belief versus non-belief. You got a 50-50 chance, but that's not it.
Right.
3,000 gods in the history of humanity versus no evidence for any of them actually existing.
Right.
Any one of those. That's...
Well, yeah. I mean, I always thought it would be kind of funny, if a little bit predatory, to have somebody use Pascal, you know, to have, like, maybe a Baptist use Pascal's wager on me and to have this conversation. Well, you know, I mean, I understand logically you don't believe in God, but is hell is terrible. And so isn't it better to make a mistake and then not go to hell than make a mistake and end up in hell? And I go, wow, you're right. Somebody get L. Ron Hubbard on the phone. That's never how they want it to work. It's an argument for their specific religion.
Yeah, it doesn't apply to anybody else.
Or even their specific implementation of their religion. You know, if somebody's like a really hardcore Catholic and they use Pascal's wager, they're going to be a little, a little unenthused if you end up as a Presbyterian.
Well, and also, not only that, when you... try and balance belief versus non-belief as equal parts, that opens up not just gods that have been purported by human culture, but you could believe in anything, and it applies to this. I believe in unicorns.
Okay.
And there is...
Well, what's the danger in not believing in unicorns?
You could get gored.
Oh, yeah. I remember that Perry Bible Fellowship. Yes.
You could believe in anything you want. I believe that Heaven's Gate cult was right, and we missed our spaceship in the Hale-Bopp comet.
Hale-Bopp. I actually
there's a great one. It's a magic comet ride. It's a cover of Magic Carpet Ride. Brilliant. Look it up.
That sounds creepy. Speaking of creepy, I actually stumbled upon my archive of the. Higher source guy recording, the Marshall Applewright recording, where it's focused on his head and he blinks like 3 times in an hour. And he's like, yeah, dude, totally, I'm Jesus. I'm going full Jesus on you. It's creepy as heck.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, Pascal's wager, I missed the boat.
Yeah.
You know, X day was in the past, so now I got to figure out how to collect all my slack.
If Pascal's wager is a good argument, why did you not die in Jonestown?
Oh, I am slain. Oh. Oh, man. So another reason this fails is no religion on earth requires simple theism to attain heaven or nirvana. Theism doesn't get you on any religious entity's good side.
I always think this is a fascinating bait and switch, even outside of this argument, but you'll see a lot of evangelicals pull this, where they say, the only thing you need to do is believe. The only thing Jesus wants from you is belief. But once you start believing, it comes with an entire laundry list of other things that now you have to do.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not the only things.
I believe in Jesus now. Bring on the heroin. Yeah, that's not going to go over with a lot of these guys. Yeah, they don't want you to be a theist. They want you to be
them.
Yeah, them. They want you to be a South by Southeast Baptist. Like I said, none of the people using this argument are going to be happy if the next thing I do is call L. Ron Hubbard.
Exactly.
Well, that's kind of hard to do. He's dead.
Are you sure?
Okay, he exteriorized. Does that help? He, I hate Pascal's Wager because we get in a, I mean, you know, it, actually 2016 Pascal's Wager is kind of, has kind of tapered off, but there have been years where we get like one Pascal's email, you know, wager email a day or a week or a month. And,
yeah. Yeah.
And that's why we have the button is it's the, in the sort of anti-atheist Christian playbook, Pascal's Wager is on page one.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm just reading too much into it because they have a book that says, you know, they believe the book says that the world is 6,000 years old. And they just haven't changed their mind on that. And, given the reams and reams and reams of evidence. But, you know, I think after trying it 5 or 6 or 70 or 80 or 9,000 times, you'd give up on it and you go for something else.
Right, right. There's a class of argument. I'm sure there's a term for this. And, you know, wonderful listeners who know so much more about everything than I do. Somebody write and tell me what this is called. There's got to be a term for this. But it's the argument that is only convincing when you already agree with what it's arguing.
Okay.
Like, to take this out of religion completely, Dan, who's on the show regularly, he can't get into soccer. I've brought him to a soccer game. We've talked about soccer. He just can't get into it. And for him, he's like, I can't stand the flopping. I can't stand the cheating. And so for him, because he already does not like soccer, that is enough of an argument standing alone to convince him to never change that opinion, which right. is fine. Like, I'm not trying to criticize Dan. He doesn't have to like soccer. But me as a soccer fan, that's just, you know, flopping something you put up with. It sucks, but, you know.
It's only, it at most, it's like 3 or 4% of the 90 minutes.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. But,
well, can we make a little side conversation?
Yes,
of this?
Please.
Because I am someone who is becoming a soccer fan.
All right.
And I hate flopping.
Yeah.
I think it stinks. There's it's poor. Everybody tells me that it's like there's a good tactical position for it, and every time I see it, it doesn't seem to work out that way. The success rate is in the single digit percentage points.
Well, for me, okay, two things on this. I love this rabbit trail, by the way. But
right.
two things on this. One, it's partially cultural.
Okay.
There are certain soccer cultures that they consider flopping an integral part of the game. It is being clever. It is doing what you can to get an advantage for your team.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Italy, places like Argentina, that it's pretty common. Places like the U.S. and places like England, they're like, no, it is cheating.
Yeah.
It's not worth lauding. It is terrible.
But I had an interesting little cognitive dissonance moment myself because you have been, because you didn't say, yeah, it's just a part of the game, accept it. You tried to get me to understand it within the context and even see it as potentially beneficial.
Okay.
You weren't, you know, that's not really where you are, but you tried to get me perhaps to understand how flopping exists in the, oh wait, by the way, flopping is when you pretend you've been hurt.
Or been fouled. You don't even have to be hurt. But
okay.
Like when you prevent, like some guy comes close to you and you drop to the ground as if they kicked your leg. So
right.
The ref comes over and calls a foul.
Right.
That's flopping.
So, yeah. And you're trying to explain to me in the soccer context and why it's not as bad as it looks. And then, you know, in the last game I went to with you, there was an intentional foul. Mm-hmm. And then you turned to explain to me, well, here's what they're doing in the intentional fouls, and I don't even let you know. I know exactly why they fouled. That makes sense. And I just had a minute where I go, so I have a problem with it with flopping, but I totally understood the intentional foul.
Right.
That's not the game. That's me.
Mm.
And so it's a little bit of a, which I think is actually kind of appropriate to ask an atheist, where it's this minute where I realized I'd been kind of holding a little bit of a double standard in my head, where I was not okay with flopping, but I totally understood and was on board for intentional fouling.
Right.
Where really, if you're really going to do the sport, play by the damn rules.
Both of those are technically cheating.
Yeah, they're both cheating.
Well, and the other thing, my other point about flopping is that I'm not convinced everything you see that you think is a flop is a flop.
Right.
And I tell this story all the time, but it really gets the point across. Me and a buddy were just kicking a ball around on a field one time. We're not soccer players. We don't know what the crap we're doing. Like, We were just kicking a ball for fun. And we were playing a little keep away, and I pull the ball away from him, and he swings out, and he clips the back of my heel. And it was like a lightning bolt straight up my leg, and I drop like a rock.
Sure.
It hurt. But within 5 seconds, it faded completely.
No, I understand that if you're not... I understand... I'm beginning to understand that. You know, if you get clipped, and you got to lay down and wait for the
stinger to go
the
away.
Stinger to go away. That's not the same thing of the guy who theoretically kicked you is 3 feet away, and you hoist yourself 6 feet in the air. Wow, is me! Oh, my tendons—they're in the next field. It's there's
most,
you know.
People flopping are not going to win Oscars anytime soon.
No. But. So the whole point of this is the way people have been explaining flopping to me all this time is to understand it within the context of the sport. I have to already be a fan in order to get this argument.
Right. So
Pascal's wager.
Pascal's
wager. Let's get back on top.
Which is exactly what I was trying to get to. That,
yeah.
Like, if you're a Christian, this argument seems like gold. Because it's like, yeah, it's not only my happy, fuzzy, emotional I'm right, but here is logic that backs me up.
Right.
And they're never going to stop and think about how the logic completely falls apart if you think about it, because they don't want it to fall apart because they have a logical argument that backs up their happy fuzzy feeling.
Right.
So
I think it's a very good argument. Yeah. I counter argument.
Yeah.
It's like, look, you're already buying into it. So this makes sense. This isn't an argument. This is marketing.
Right.
And that's where it comes to the last point on this, which is the people who dish it out don't take it. Religious folks, you know, usually, like you said, usually Christians who use Pascal's wager as the first, you know, page of their book,
mm-hmm.
they don't simultaneously follow other religious rules. We're falling into a thing I talked about before, which is the agnosticism paradox, where
right.
agnosticism, which Pascal's wager is an agnostic argument. Because it's not an argument that starts with God exists. It says God may or may not exist. So you can do this or you can do this other thing. And here are the risks involved. This argument posits agnosticism. And
right.
the agnostic, what's that?
Right.
Yeah. And the agnostic problem here is you can act in a way where no gods exist and you can wait for proof, to show that a certain God exists, or you can act in a way that all potential gods exist, which you're not able to do, and you would have no free time.
Yeah.
So if these folks actually believed in Pascal's wager and used Pascal's wager as the basis of their theological concept, there's no reason they shouldn't keep halal or kosher
mm-hmm.
or eat only meat or eat only vegetables or never bathe or bathe in a specific place or bathe every day or use toilet paper or don't use toilet paper or pray in one direction, pray in another direction, pray in all directions, get a weird zero gravity harness so that you can pray at specific stars at specific times.
You can pray like that that final, like in the last Starfighter, that little special weapon they had that shot in all directions.
Yeah, pray like that. Actually, it's an interesting thing. So I've always had this question in the back of my mind that I never wanted to ask because I wasn't certain if it was insulting or not. But if Muslims settle another planet, how do they pray to Mecca? Do they need like a weird orrery so that they know where to point? Like, do they need a special harness? Do they establish a new Mecca on a planet?
That's a really good question.
Conversation.
I don't think that, well, okay, depending on the Muslim that you run into, I think most Muslims are perfectly okay with that. I feel like don't go to Syria anytime soon and start asking that question.
But it's one of those questions, you know, if it occurred to me, it probably occurred to a billion other people.
Yeah.
And it's like us getting Pascal's wager, where the guy goes, this again? Really? Well, here, let me press the button on my broadcast board that answers this question. Yeah, and so that's actually part of the reason why I haven't followed up on it.
Yeah, there's There's this great moment in a terrible movie. I hate this movie, but The Mummy. Do you remember that one?
Oh, I love Fraser? That movie.
Okay.
It's terrible.
I love that movie.
There's this great part where, and I can't remember the character's name, the little sidekick Egyptian guy who pulls out the necklace and it has a cross and it has an ankh and it has a Star of David and it has a crescent. And he's just going through praying to each one.
Yeah.
This is a guy who understands Pascal's wager.
Yeah. This is a guy kind of on the other side of the agnostic conundrum, which is, yeah, he carries a bunch of, and he just flips through it.
Whatever works.
And if you remember, in the context of that movie, it works.
This is true.
Because he gets the Star of David, and the mummy guy's, oh, the religion of the slaves. I will work with you and not murder you. And yeah, that's basically what this is you're not making a specific religious argument. This is a specific religious argument that only works in, like, the Christendom era of Europe, where the only religion you could see for as far as you could travel in any direction was one singular religion, because Christianity was religion. There were no alternatives. They murdered all of the other alternatives.
Right.
In a world where you have a plurality of religions, where you have a diverse society with many people with many religious beliefs and a lot of us without any religious belief, Pascal's wager, it just logically fails.
Yes,
because
completely.
It does not, it makes no statement about why I should believe your specific religion.
Right.
Because it's not all run by the Pope. And that's why this... That's why this argument sucks, and that's why I hate it, and that's why I have the button.
Which we will stick with a button. It's fun.
I like the button. Yeah. It's.
I'm honestly really glad that we got the chance to actually play it out, because I did spend a good half hour writing that down, and we'd never actually gotten a chance for all our listeners to hear what it said, because we always talk over it. So
yeah, I knew the day would come where I would press the button. I've always thought about making an iPhone app. That was literally just the Pascal's wager button, where it would play that and would play that audio. I might still do that, but
the one I want, and I don't think we have the rights for it, but I want to get a button that plays "Christmas Time Is Here" by the Vince Guaraldi Trio from their Charlie Brown special. So anytime when you need to, you can hit that and hang your head and walk away slowly. And everyone knows you're sad.
It's the I lost an argument button.
Exactly.
I like that. That's good. I knew there would come a day when we would get to play it without talking over it. I was just waiting for the right moment. And I think this is the right moment.
I think this is.
And there was a quote that we read at the end of the episode in 2011. And I think I'm going to read it again because I love this quote. "Live a good life. If there are gods and they are just, they will not care how devout you have been, but will welcome you based on the virtues you have lived by. If there are gods, but unjust, then you should not want to worship them. If there are no gods, then you will be gone, but you'll live a good and noble life that will live on in the memories of your loved ones." And that's Marcus Aurelius.
Been a good quote for 1,700 years?
Something like that.
I see no reason.
Marcus Aurelius, I think it's a little over 2,000.
Yeah. Under 2,000. He was, because Julius Caesar was 2,000 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Marcus Aurelius definitely came after that.
Yeah. I'm bad at math.
History nerds!
Yeah! I'm a history, I like history, but I'm also bad at math. Anyway. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. See you in a bit.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait, not sacrificing children, that's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanistsofwashington.org.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month, we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Joining me now is Becky. Hello.
Hi, Sam.
And Carol, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. So we've got some emails here to cover, so we're going to cover them. I don't think we really need to go into that much further than that. This one, actually, I don't really know that I have a good answer for, so I think I'll be leaning on you guys. I look forward to seeing how this goes. This is Chris from the UK, who writes, I was raised Christian until I found a Jewish website that explained how the New Testament contradicts the Old. I now describe myself as agnostic, but I'm still afraid that there may be a hell. This is stopping me from living my life. While I doubt that I'll become a Christian again, I sometimes wonder if there's any chance the Jewish faith was right. Is there any way that I might be able to let go of this fear? Well, some way to make a firm decision on whether or not I should be religious. Maybe some way I should make a firm decision on whether or not I should be religious. People have advised me to learn more about religion and the world in general. Maybe there's something specific I should look at. So personally, I won't pretend that I didn't have a fear of hell when I was a kid. It was certainly, somebody tried very hard to slam it into my head, and it scared me. But I didn't have the same constant pressure that people who are religious had about eternal damnation or absence of God. So it was a fairly easy thing for me to let go of. I don't know about you guys.
I didn't grow up with a concept of hell either, since I came from a Jewish background. So it was of particular interest to me that Chris came upon this crisis of faith by stumbling upon a Jewish website. But here's the thing. I'm almost certain that the Jewish text that you came across, or the blog entry or the commentary that said, hey, the Old Testament contradicts the New, or the New contradicts the Old, is a way to try and alleviate the fears of practicing Jews, to say, no, you don't have to believe this thing that they call the New Testament. It's completely contradictory. Ours is the only one truth. So I would definitely take that with many, many, many grains of kosher salt, Chris. But Carol, you grew up in a Christian environment,
no,
right?
I didn't, actually. Okay. I grew up in an atheist, but like the passive, just don't really talk about it environment. But I was drinking the Kool-Aid real heavy through college and for a couple of years after. Hell was a thing that I worried about, and then I stopped worrying about it. And I think what it was is, it's not like I was able to like let go of part of it and then not other parts of it. Like, if you're going to let go of part of it, like, just release the whole thing. Like, if you're starting to believe that maybe there's not a God, like, why would a hell even exist? That it doesn't work for me. But I mean, as far as like how to let go of the fear, I guess for me, I always took, you know, belief system like very pragmatically. I mean, it's not just, is there a God or isn't there? Is there a hell or isn't there? It's like, what if we're all, you know, brains and vats? What if all of this is a dream? What if we're a computer simulation? You know, there's a lot of what ifs. And at some point, you just have to say, like, you know what? It makes the most sense to me if the world is like this. And so I will act as though the world is like this because that's what brings the most peace to my life. And I don't have to act through fear because that just doesn't seem to work out well for people. And then if you're wrong, you know what? That's a problem for future you. But, you know, why? You can't prove it. There's no way. So just... If it doesn't make sense to you, then don't buy it.
Yeah, I think I've shared this before, but my first little touch of agnosticism, and Chris, you say that you now consider yourself agnostic. My first little touch of that was when I was about 7 years old and I was asking my dad because a neighbor friend had had their grandmother die. And I was asking about heaven and hell and being reunited with your loved ones. And my dad said, nobody knows. Nobody knows. We could die and suddenly we're standing at pearly gates with a big fat Buddha wearing a yarmulke. And to me, that was that little introduction of, you know, nobody knows. And when you're dealing with the death of a loved one, you have things that try and comfort you, but that also that speaks to this fear and the mourning and the loss. You know, usually when we say like, hey, should I keep believing in hell just because I'm afraid it might be true, we kind of toss that off as a Pascal's wager and kind of, you know, give it its little run.
This isn't Pascal's wager at all, and I think you're making I think you're making light of this guy's fear, and I think that's a real problem. And let me go into why. This goes back, and maybe this will help him understand my position on it, and it may help him, it may not. But the problem is the God, the heaven-hell dichotomy that a lot of religions have, because it's not just Christianity. Most religions have some sort of dichotomy. This is where it comes to where I think it's a method of social control. It's one of the earliest effective behavioral control things that we have as humanity. It's the carrot and stick approach. The carrot is heaven. The stick is hell. And so people who seek to control other populations of people via religion, one of the major ways they do that is fear of reproach from your God, and that's going for eternal hellfire. And that's why the description of hell in religion tends to be so dark and so incompatible with these concepts of deities who actually give a crap about us one way or another. And they, and a lot of preachers, give them hellfire. They make sure that their sheep or whatever really understand what they mean when they're talking about eternal damnation. In other words, they really buy into it. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And that's a fear that persists well beyond a conversion to atheism. I've had this conversation with a lot of atheists, and part of the reason that I don't talk about it on the show is because I am not the venue for this. I don't have a good answer for this because I've never felt the fear in the same way they have. And it's not been drilled into me since I was a child. For a lot of people, it was. And I mean, I can say you can look at the internal contradictions between this all-loving creature that is proposed to control our lives and be our creator versus the idea of eternal damnation towards people who don't believe in him. But these are intellectual conversations, and we're trying to answer an emotional hit with an intellectual answer. And that's never particularly fulfilling. And I really think the people we go to for this kind of question might not be us. It might be people who have made that conversion and who have either moved on from it or are still fighting it.
Well, and I think that the idea of answering an emotional question with an intellectual answer, I mean, that actually does work sometimes. If the emotion, Sam, you and I have talked frequently about like our issues with depression or anxiety or things like that.
Right.
And a lot of the answer is like, well, I feel this way and I feel this way very strongly, but to rely on the like intellectual, but I know this. And so I have to hold on to this until this emotion changes.
But I'm not going to take a internal, I'm not saying don't make the intellectual statements. I think they absolutely need to be made. But I think it should be made in a context of people who understand that there's an emotional battle going on as well. And I am not certain that the three of us sitting at this table understand that.
I'm not certain either, and I do want to extend an apology to Chris for what seems like making light of the fear that he's facing. I think that the link between making light of it actually comes from something that wasn't a fear-based thing in me, but something that was ingrained in me, and that was from growing up, this aversion to eating pork products, and well beyond, as you said, leaving, you know, Sam, well beyond the point at which you reject a deity, you sometimes still have these little, you know, twinges of doubt in you or just of discomfort. And Carol, it was your house where I first was able to like thoroughly enjoy an actual pork loin. At Christmas, no less.
I do what I can.
So for me, that was actually an easy way to sort of fondly recall this shedding of sort of this ingrained discomfort, which I will admit is definitely different from a fear.
If we could more directly directly answer this, I was under the impression from you that there was no singular concept of hell for Jews, and that some people, and that there's a significant portion of the population of Jews who don't believe in one entirely, but remain otherwise observant.
Right. There's sort of an historical perspective on hell, depending on what time of the writings you were looking at. And it sort of mirrors whatever other population of people, the Hebrews and then later on the Jews, were sort of around at the time.
Yep.
So the concept of the afterlife really has evolved and changed in Judaism.
There's not even one concept of hell in Christianity either. I remember doing a retreat and doing a Bible study, and we're starting to look at some of these things in the New Testament, you know, weeping and gnashing of teeth and all of that. And, you know, we came to the, well, it doesn't really say anything about fire in here. What if it's just like an eternity of not hanging out with God? You know, there's
right.
no torture, no pitchforks, no none of that. It's just you don't get into heaven. You're stuck outside the party for forever.
The interesting thing is that once you start walking down that path, which is it's, you know, hell isn't torture the way that Stone Age primitives have it. It's actually just a world without God in it. The more you talk to these people about what hell looks like, the more it seems like they're talking about the world we live in now. When it's so difficult to prove, when you're not allowed to prove that God exists, because it has to be an article of faith, and then you then say that hell is a world without God in it, it starts to look a little bit like the world that exists now. I think perhaps you could aim for something a bit in a Kafka vein, but even then that seems... I mean, that was kind of Kafka's whole point, is that weird, you know, real life can be pretty absurd and mean to you if you don't pay attention to it. Although I would not claim to speak for Kafka at
yeah.
all. Wow,
and,
no.
Yeah. And I mean, you said, you know, this isn't necessarily Pascal's wager, and like Pascal's wager, whether or not this is it, can go a couple of ways, because it's like, you know, you can spend your life wondering, am I doing this wrong? Because what if hell is out there waiting for me? But the other one is, you know, what if it's not out there
right.
waiting for you? And then you spent your whole life in fear of, you know, what could have been, but wasn't actually.
Yeah. I mean, I would not, you know, I do have a button specifically for people who use Pascal's wager on us, but I don't think this is an appropriate use of the button, because this isn't somebody who's saying he's not making the Pascal's wager argument at us. This is
yeah.
somebody who's escaping into Pascal as a way to avoid an emotional fear without a logical basis. So this isn't a situation where I'm going to make fun of the guy, unless it turns out he's lying, then, well, you know. But I've not seen a question formulated like this.
And I think that the other answer, Sam, as you said, maybe it's not us who answers this fully for you. Chris, you've already had friends or other people say, hey, go learn about more religion. Go learn about the world in general, other religions. If it was learning about the scriptures from a Jewish perspective that set you off onto this agnostic twist and turn, maybe, you know, you'll have your fears alleviated through learning about even more of the worldviews and religions that are out there.
Right. I mean, my point is the reason you believe in hell is because it was very important for the people who would control you for you to do so. That's always what I've said. But that, again, that's an intellectual argument that doesn't delete the fear. I think the deletion of fear, to go back to what you're talking about, Carol, about the way we deal with depression, is we let the intellectual arguments carry the day, or at least try to let the intellectual arguments carry the day, until the emotions sort themselves out. And in this case, I think, experiencing life may be the, you know, what goes on. Exactly as you say, Becky, continue going and talking to these people. Do your own, you know, do some of your own research, because it could be very liberating. Read the books. I'd just say continue what you're doing. And I think the fear will sort itself out.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have another email. This is Craig from California, who writes, a while ago, you covered the Canadian parents who murdered their son by woo. You want to be easy on them. You disgust me. We should throw the book at them. If adult children would murder their parents for their inheritance, would it you be easy on them because they are orphans?
Sam?
No? Okay. Here's the fun thing, is I mentioned these questions because, and I mentioned my questioning of going harder after them specifically because I thought maybe the death of their kids would be punishment enough and they'd know better. In the very conversation you're referring to, it becomes clear that they don't, and I rescind my position. But it just seems that you want me to get the pitchforks and the torches out just because of this, and that's not something I'm ever going to do. Maybe I'll get offended, maybe I'll yell and scream a bit, but if you're telling me that I shouldn't have space to have a discussion on this, I shouldn't have space to disagree with the going intelligence on the situation, you're listening to the wrong show and we're not on the same side. And that's the beginning and the end of it. I actually, in the course of the very conversation you're talking about, come around to believe that they should probably get a heavier sentence than they received. That they did not learn by it, and the death of their children was not torture enough, apparently, or punishment enough, because sometimes the line between torture and punishment is difficult to understand. And I personally think that incarceration and our punishment system is supposed to be to rehabilitate. It's not supposed... I don't believe in this Victorian punishment concept, personally. It doesn't seem to get us anywhere. And that's why I talk about it. But I can be wrong. And I fully admit, even in the context of the conversation that you're talking about, to be wrong. If you just want me to just be angry at people, I mean, I can do that, but maybe that's not the episode for you.
I am really aghast at Craig's false dichotomy here between a set of parents trying to treat their child as misguided as it would have been. Now, in this case, it was treating a child with maple syrup and other kind of spices and herbs.
Right.
As you said, a salad, Sam, right? Treat your kids
meningitis
with a salad.
They wanted to prepare their kids with a salad.
Right. Those parents are directly trying to heal their child. With the thing that you propose, Craig, if children murder their parents so they can get an inheritance, we should be easy on them because we should feel bad because they're orphans and they've lost their parents. They're trying to get an inheritance by means of killing their parents. The parents who were trying to treat their kids' illness with maple syrup were not trying to achieve some means via killing their child. So, you're pulling the pitchforks out on Sam, even despite his, rescinding his statement or his question, I guess, at that point, and by posing a false dichotomy that's just absurd on its face.
I guess my question here, I'm not entirely familiar with the story or this previous conversation, but by go easy, like, were you advocating at some point like a lesser prison sentence or just like...
They received a very light prison sentence, and there is a call to give them a much larger sentence because they were imprisoned for a short period of time. They are now released, and they're still saying that it would have worked if only those damn kids didn't get involved or something like that.
Okay. It seems like you personally, Sam, are being asked to go harder on them as though you are the arbiter of the Canadian justice system.
Well, I mean, I think I should be held accountable for what I say on the show.
Okay.
Full stop. You know, I mean, but I do believe that even if I'm held accountable for what I say on the show, that accountability should, one, be accurate, which is this is not, and two, should be logical, which, as Becky points out, this is not.
Wait, you're not the arbiter of the entire Canadian justice system?
I'm not the arbiter. Not so as you'd know.
not yet.
You know, that doesn't mean that when I get it wrong, I shouldn't be called to question on it. And in fact, I was called out on that very episode. Was it by Dave?
I think it was.
Yeah. And I agreed that I was incorrect. And I think we should have more examples of that and not less of that in the atheist podcastosphere. I don't know. I don't always want to just fall in ideological line every time something like this happens. Because for me, it's not about ideology, it's about evidence. And being about evidence means being about what works. And would punishing these parents further do anything? Would it achieve any particular goal? And apparently in this case, because they still haven't figured out that a salad does not kill cancer, or does not cure cancer, maybe punishment may be the way to go.
Okay.
That leads to several deeper conversations, which may actually be outside the scope of Ask an Atheist.
But it sounds like you got there the first time around, so this question was preemptively answered?
I think this question I'm not ideologically in line with modern atheism, because I didn't immediately get out the pitchforks and torches. And if that's your supposition, I wholeheartedly agree with you.
I do want to say one really nice thing about Craig, because in addition to apparently pitchforking Sam, he did extend his condolences and sympathies on the demise of one of our furry family members. So we do appreciate that.
Okay.
But be a little bit more critical in your listening, Craig.
No. I wouldn't say be more critical in his listening. I'm okay with his level of criticality. And that's why I'm trying to walk a line by saying, I think this email is full of crap, but I do not think Craig is. I'm trying to critique the question and not the person.
Okay.
There are some people who are just, you know, they just go off the rails and but this isn't one of those. Follow-up email would not be unappreciated. And the next time I do something that you disagree with, Craig, I would not mind hearing from you again. Just let's try and argue the situation, I guess. All right, one more email. This one's Lindsay from the internet, who writes, human beings are highly intelligent and creative. We are able to create many devices, from smartphones and laptops to vehicles and huge skyscrapers and even medicine. Now let's pretend for a moment that I asked a rock to create a smartphone. That would be a bit silly, wouldn't it? A rock is a rock. The best thing a rock can do is, well, sit there and be a rock. While I understand that human beings use our planet's resources to create all these devices, I have never seen a human create an entire planet. So if you and I are way smarter than a rock, yet still lack the ability to create a planet, why do atheists and scientists believe that a rock has the ability to create a planet?
Record scratch, what?
No. Because it's a lie. It's not an appeal to emotion, but it's basically an appeal to anti-intellectualism in a lot of ways. This is some creationist trying to be clever. We've seen a million of these guys on the internet go, well, yeah, okay, rock, create a smartphone. See, it's not creating a smartphone. Therefore, all of the theories behind cosmogenesis and up that don't involve Jesus are a lie. And it's kind of lame.
I I get to that last line about like rock creating a planet something, and I just like my brain sort of fuzzes out because it's one of those like I understand all those words but not in that order. Maybe it's just that we're using the word create differently, but there's this Saturday morning breakfast cereal cartoon that Dave showed me recently that's talking, it's this guy ranting about how like upsetting it is that, you know, that all the apostles didn't recognize that Jesus was just three monkeys in a big robe, and like this pastor is just standing there kind of like flat-footed and bemused, because that is bemused is not the right word there,
right.
Flat-footed and confused, because that is not at all like the story. And the punchline is that that's how frustrating it is when atheists are asked why they believe whatever it is that we don't actually believe.
Right.
And that's what's happening here, is someone's asking me, why do I believe that a rock can create a planet? And it's like, that's not a thing.
Well, it also comes from a place of misunderstanding, is that the idea of you know, planetary and stellar formation does not require matter to do anything that it doesn't already do. It's not like a rock suddenly turns into, and this is a place of uneducation. This is listening only to the people who tell you that it's wrong, and not listening to the people who actually do the evidence and do the research and figure this stuff out. You need to, if you're going to actively, and a lot of people on Facebook who should be hearing this, if you're going to actually try to refute the side of, you know, the side of the evidence, you need to have a handle on the evidence. And you don't have a handle of the evidence here. You have a handle of what somebody has told you about the evidence. A person who doesn't believe that evidence and has every cause to color how that evidence is for you. So what you're being told basically is that a rock has some sort of non-rock quality when it's involved in planetary formation. It doesn't. The only thing a rock does, either in liquid, gas, or solid form, is be a rock. The major player in stellar formation is gravity. And all you need for gravity is a whole lot of mass. And you know what rocks got? A whole lot of mass. There's a lot of rock out there. I mean, we're sitting on a few million megatons of it right now. And that's all that is absolutely necessary for stellar formation to occur. Now, there are people who know this and then have kicked the argument further down the road and create similar arguments. But it's bad arguments all the way down. It's almost always a misunderstanding of the evidence. There is nothing that a rock can do right now that it needs to do in order for planetary formation to occur. And I am no expert on planetary formation. I'm not a physicist. I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm not a anything physicist. I'm not a scientist anything. But I do read books and I do check out the evidence. And it's not like a rock spits out. It's not like a Michael Bay movie where rocks spit out a bunch of extra tools and go to work in stellar formation. All it is just rocks being rocks, but in such quantity that it has effects you might not otherwise see, much like what is going on at the core of the planet right now, which is why compasses work.
You know, as I was looking at this, trying to figure out where Lindsay was getting their assumptions about atheists, and looking into where this misinformation and miseducation, as you said, Sam, might have originated, I did a little bit of digging around internet publications and postings, and came across a few things that seem to suggest that people believe that, or people have this understanding that the Big Bang means rocks that pre-existed, apparently, banging into each other and then creating life and the planets and things like that. And I'm wondering if this is a conflation for Lindsay of the formation of planets, the formation of stars, and the beginning of life. And sort of how, you know, we talk about the evidence that, or the hypothesis that there is a, you know, the primordial soups and the, you know, electrical charges that then create, you know, that have the formation of amino acids,
well,
and maybe a lipid membrane.
Okay, but we're getting into things that are, well, related because they all exist in the universe. So it gets pretty complex. And so we lose the thread of what's going on. I mean, to get specific to what her about rocks creating planets, here's a fun one. Rocks didn't exist for a few billion years after the universe was created because it needed stars in order to create the higher elements.
And here we come back to that create and created thing.
Right.
We're talking about formation, right?
Right. Yeah, it's
hard because English, permeates everything that we think about.
Right.
And I think it's also one of those, like, I tend to think of a planet as, in very simplified terms, made out of rocks. And so to, like, be the analogy is that arguing that, like, I'm made out of organs, therefore organs created me.
Right.
Like, is that the argument that's happening here? Like, that's the logic?
Well, you can find flaws in an argument like this in a lot of places. For example, stars are not made out of rocks.
Oh, no, they're not.
Yeah, they're just not. Rocks don't happen in stars. Rocks are a result of stellar evolution. They're not involved in the creation of stars. Which is, you know, also planets. Not all of them are made out of rocks. Some of them are made out of gas. It just goes on and on and on. But, you know, the idea is not to throw so much data at them that they get confused. The idea is to refute the specific argument and then invite them to get other data, which is what I'm trying to do.
I'm hoping that Lindsay can get the other data from a place where someone isn't trying to manipulate what atheists believe for the purposes of boosting up their own creationist beliefs.
That is the idea. I mean, that's exactly what we're asking for here. And that's the end of this podcast. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can voicemail us at 844-753-7842. That's 844-SKEPTIC. You can visit us on Twitter on AskAnAtheistWA. This episode was pre-recorded. Thank you guys very much. See you next week.